The first reading this morning comes from two sources, one from the Hebrew Scriptures and one from the Gospel of Thomas, which was originally written in Greek. The Gospel of Thomas is not found in the New Testament, but since its discovery in the mid-last century, it has been regarded by scholars since the 1960s as an important document with some authentic stories apparently told by Jesus, but not found in the four canonical Gospels. But first, the legend from the Hebrew Scriptures about the prophet Elijah, or Eliyah in Hebrew.
So the prophet Eliyah went out to the territory of Fisherland, where he found the town of Metal Forge. When he ambled up to the gate, a widow was there gathering tinder branches off the ground. He called to her and asked, "Do you have any water I might drink?" She nodded and went off to get some water. Then the prophet added, "Got any bread to spare?" She said to him, "Look, I swear I have no baked goods in my house to share with you. All I have is some flour in a clay pot and a little jar of olive oil. I am gathering tinder here to make my last meal. My son and I will eat the bread I bake from the flour and oil. After that, we'll probably starve to death." Eliyah said to her, "Don't be frightened. Go and bake your last bread. Then bring me some and feed yourself and your son. For so says the Eternal, your clay pot will never be empty of flour, and your jar of olive oil will never run out of oil until the very day this drought ends and rain falls, so we can grow grain again." So she followed his directive, and just as he foresaw, together they survived for many days on the food of her household. The pot was never emptied. The jar of oil never ran out. Now, number 97 from the Gospel of Thomas, which is clearly a springboard reflection, what rabbis call midrash, on this ancient tale. This is what God's sovereignty looks like. A woman is carrying a clay pot filled with flour. While she was journeying down the road and was still some distance off, the handle of the jar broke, and flour spilled out behind her. She had no idea. She didn't notice any problems. But when she reached her house and put the clay pot down, she discovered it was empty.
The second reading comes from an interview with the late and controversial author Mary Daly, who died last week at age 81. Her radical books, like her book Guy and Ecology, were published by our own Unitarian Universalist Beacon Press. Nobody else was willing to, apparently.
"It's a strange phenomenon to become an icon. There's nothing of you in it. I try to encourage women to think for themselves. I don't care if they like my words. I mean, I love it that they like my words, but make up some of your own. You know, it seems to me that if you spend a lot of time criticizing rather than creating, that suggests a lack. True, I do have critiques of French feminist author Simone de Beauvoir. There are a lot of ways in which I think she's wrong, but I don't spend a lot of pages on that. I respect her for what she's done. So I think that a focus on criticism is just a way of leaning on me or on any village guru, and that's not what I ever want to be. Instead, branch out. My intention, say, in writing Gynecology was for it to be a springboard, and instead I get, you didn't do it perfectly. There's something wrong with what you did. Oh, go to hell. It's just a springboard. You carry on when you have more specific knowledge.
I've been thinking a lot about our mission statement ever since we created it together last year. A lot of work. It made me proud when I remember how excited our Unitarian Universalist Association moderator, Ginny Quarter, was when she read it the first time. She thought it was the best she had ever seen in our association. I've been thinking about our mission statement all this last week. I've been thinking about how all of the phrases flow together into an articulate whole. It really seems to fully embody this month's theme word, justice, and very elegantly too. And I've been thinking about our mission statement these last few days as I have been remembering Professor Mary Daly, who died last week at age 81. Some of you may know her, many of you probably don't, but I certainly do. Now, as one might expect about a polarizing figure as she was, much of what I read about her online this week is simply nonsense. Pure paranoid fiction. Some said that as a radical feminist who taught at Boston College for many years, she didn't speak to men. Ever. False. That's simply not true. She tutored men one-on-one. She welcomed them into her classes, just some of her classes, but not all of them. And she was clear about her reasons why. She was strong and unbending, which always makes people feel uncomfortable. I understand that. Strength and clarity are often frightening in this modern world of ours, where deception, innuendo, greed, deviousness, and outright denial have successfully claimed center stage. Other critics claim that she warned her students only to read women's works, women's philosophy. Again, simply not true. Don't believe anything you read on the internet, as a matter of fact. She taught Thomas Aquinas, a man. She taught Aristotle, a man, openly and admiringly because of their complex ways of reasoning. But there is no question that she was quite a radical in her views, despite the pissy and paranoid exaggerations that anyone can find on the free-for-all internet. Mary Daly's difficult books were alive, when I was in seminary. We all read them. Some of us trembled as we read them. They made a lot of men really mad, and they made some women mad too. Her language was always a form of pure fury. Having said this, I want to be clear about something. Some of the statistical figures that fueled her rage in 1978 when her book Gynecology came out have proven erroneous. That is, they have not been supported by facts uncovered since by historians. Historians totally sympathetic to radical feminist critiques of society. Hear me now. I'm not saying that even accusing one woman in history of being a witch and then burning her is anything less than evil, because it is. But Daly's figure of 9 million in Europe during the late Middle Ages is way too high, recent scholars and historians affirm. It's too high by 8.5 million. That's exactly why I had Sydney offer the reading of her words about such criticism. My intention, she said, in writing Gynecology was for it to be a springboard for you. And instead I get, you didn't do it perfectly. There's something wrong with what you did. Oh, go to hell. It's just a springboard. You carry on when you have more knowledge. In other words, she is not concerned that anyone accept her word on her authority, settled once and for all, but that we each engage in figuring things out for ourselves with more accurate information if it comes about. But each person still has to claim their own authority with whatever information they have. Exactly. Even if Mary Daly was brilliant, and she was, you still have to figure things out for yourselves. Male or female or anything else, you have to experiment with the way things are in life. As I said last week, Gandhi promoted this approach, and Martin Luther King Jr., experimenting with the truth, not listening to any woman or man tell us that they have final access to the truth, direct from the Almighty, or worse, because they are internationally famous or own half the world. I was lucky enough to see the astonishing musical Spring Awakening recently. One of the leads in the musical sings these lyrics. It's a great song. All they say is, trust what is written. Thought is suspect, and money is their idol, and nothing is okay unless it's scripted in their Bible. But I know there is much more to find just in looking through myself and not at them. I know to trust my true mind and to say, there is a way through this. So I think experiential learning, experimentation, if you will, is important for figuring out who and what I really trust. I think this is true because I experimented one day with one of Mary Daly's practices, and I learned a lot by doing so. She did indeed keep men out of one of her classes because she felt that many, if not all men, would dominate the conversation and silence women in the classroom unconsciously by talking over, talking down, talking out of turn, interrupting. Some would fill the room with their voices and offer no spaciousness, which could draw out the voices that were too often stifled by our sexist culture. She had experienced this in her life too many times to suspect her own thought on this observation. So, one day, when I was in New Haven, Connecticut, at Yale University, attending one of our Unitarian Universalist religious conferences, which we call General Assembly, I attended a workshop. Now, thousands were gathered at that famous campus. There were lots of very large meetings, but there were lots of smaller, cozier meetings, too, and I attended one of those. 23 others attended also. I was the only man. I don't remember what the topic was now. All I remember was that it was the most interesting topic scheduled for that particular hour of the day, as far as I was concerned. I went into the room with lots of ideas, many observations to make about the topic. I was ready to speak. A woman presented for about 10 minutes and then opened things up for a conversation on the topic. Just as the discussion began, I was ready. I most certainly had something to say. I had wisdom. I had nifty quotations to offer. But then, for some reason, I don't know why, I suddenly thought of Mary Daly. And so I decided to experiment with one of her approaches. I asked myself to remain quiet and to say nothing. No one knew I was doing this. I just sat in the back of the room and tried to look as invisible as I could. Every time a woman spoke, I indeed immediately found a response forming in my head or my heart, a clever comment, a decisive question. But I bit my tongue and I kept quiet. And I mean, I bit my tongue. It was hard work for me, not just as Mark, but as a man, I discovered. I wanted to say all sorts of things, but then I asked myself, why? I stayed in that room for an hour and a half, and I didn't say a single word. I think I actually sprained my tongue that day. But I also learned something. Mary Daly was not a monster for keeping men out of a classroom where a particular subject was being discussed. She understood something about our unconscious social conditioning and responses, something which I hope I have not forgotten after my little experiment. And I've conducted that experiment a number of other times. I invite you to do so. Now, I use this story to begin to explain why I think the 4 points of our mission statement are so powerful. As I see it, their power stems from the fact that they blend into a seamless whole. They are not so much as a list of 4 distinct ideas piled on top of one another, but rather 4 facets of a single jewel, or 4 streams flowing into a single river. So let me unpack what I mean for a moment. Here's our mission statement. We are here to learn and practice true hospitality, to revere the reasoning mind and the generous heart, to claim our diversity as a source of our strength, and to relinquish the safety of our unexamined privilege for the freedom to engage in transforming justice. Now, regarding my story, you might suggest right off that I was clearly relinquishing privilege by keeping silent. Yes, I suppose I was. That was the original point of the experiment. But listen, I also think that I was struggling to practice what our statement calls true hospitality. But you weren't welcoming anyone into the room, you may say. It wasn't even your workshop, and you didn't even say a word. Precisely. Because welcoming people into the room would have been a good traditional form of hospitality, but not by far the deeper, truest one. Traditionally, I can welcome anyone I want into the home that I own, the loft where I live. But I do not own ideas. I do not own communities. I was simply one part of that community on that particular day, and I felt called to a true hospitality, by which I mean this. True hospitality is not me, one who belongs, welcoming others who do not belong. A truer, deeper, or if you want, more radical way to view hospitality is that it is always mutual. Totally, absolutely mutual. If you go up and welcome a visitor into our building here for the first time, you hopefully are not doing this as some club member welcoming an outsider. No, if you welcome someone with true hospitality, it suggests that you are also being welcomed. Welcomed into that other person's life as much as you are welcoming that person to share community with you. You who may have been coming here for 20 years or more. Visitors are making themselves vulnerable enough to enter into a circle of what to them are all strangers. That's quite remarkable when you think of it. They are opening up their door to you as much as you might be opening our door to them. And I was also using reason in that room. In Yale, we are here to revere the reasoning mind, we wrote. I reasoned that it would be beneficial to my soul to experiment with one of Mary Daly's demands, and my reasoning proved sound. Now, our spiritual history, as many of you know, touts reason a lot. It's one of our big words, reason. But it does not ever lift up what I like to call tinker toy reason. In the story of Eliyah or Elijah and the magic clay pot, for example, tinker toy reason is the kind of reason that only asserts that because magic things like pots that never empty never happen in the present world, therefore they never happened in the biblical world. Tinker toy reason deals with yes and no only, and says there are no magic clay pots anywhere, so therefore there weren't any in biblical times. Tinker toy reasoning looks at the miracles in a sentence and neglects the rest of the sentence. But our tradition asks us to reason more deeply. Ask more. Notice the whole of things. So notice that the woman in the story is a widow. Her husband died. There was no social system in those days, no social network to catch her. She was about to starve to death. Notice that the prophet, who speaks out of his deep spirituality, doesn't work this wonder to dazzle her, but to feed her. His magic pot of flour is not to convince people of his power or God's power, but to help a woman in deep trouble survive. Could the fable be only an ancient and quite beautiful way of asking, if religion is not at least about service to those suffering social injustices, then what is it about? So yes, in that room at Yale, I was reasoning. Reasoning that my life might grow deeper and maybe more generous and kind if I tried some radical shifts in my behavior. I figured out that experimenting with Mary Daly's practice might get me through this hour spiritually much more reliably than would my unconscious habits as a privileged man of many words and a man who also talks to think. And I was also looking back, trying to be serious about the deeper meanings of diversity. I was trying to find strength in that diversity in the room. Again, diversity in the room is not simple biology. That is, too much of a surface understanding of things. But in that room of women, some were married, some were divorced, some were remarried, others were single, some were living in some stated partnership with a man or a woman. Some were grieving deeply for a loss, others were not. Some were in love, some did not know if they ever were in love in their life. Some were suffering from chronic pain, others just ran a marathon and won quite painlessly. Some were mothers. Some couldn't get pregnant no matter what they did. There were some who experienced very powerful ethnic cultural shaping in their home of origin, and others who had no idea that they had any roots at all. When the women started to comment on the topic at hand that day, while I sat silently by, all of these diverse realities surfaced in some way or another. And as I listened silently, I felt empowered and grateful. The revelation of all this diversity strengthened me. What I am saying is that our mission statement is not a sober portrait of what we are right now, but what we are practicing to be and to do in the world. It's about our own transformations as well as the world's transformation. In short, it's a summons to practice our religious way of life in four distinct but completely united ways, each flowing one into the other. But why, you may ask, did I read those two biblical stories? What do they really have to do with anything? The first story is one of a series of folk legends about the prophet Elijah, or Eliyah, who for the ancient Hebrews was kind of like a Paul Bunyan character, a folk hero around which many tall tales gathered. As I said, it's more of a story about social justice than it is about any bona fide miracle or God's intervention in history. But the author of the Gospel of Thomas is worried about how easily such stories can be interpreted in kind of a magic way. So the author recalls a contrasting story that Jesus told once, which turned that story upside down. A woman has a clay pot filled with flour, but the pot is cracked and it all leaks out. The poor woman doesn't notice the thing. And the author says this twice just to make sure that you get the point. And so when she gets home, her clay pot is empty. Call this story an unmagic story if you want. Her pot is not magically filled to the top. In fact, it quite unmagically empties out because of a crack she doesn't notice. For me, the story is saying two things. One, forget any get-me-off-the-hook interpretation of the story, where a greater power simply supplies your need by a finger snap. Really, just forget about it. It doesn't happen. Wonders and signs won't help Haiti. Mere human beings will. But two, the needs of the world for nourishment and for home, twin symbols of justice, they're all real. The woman is on a journey, the story says, as are we all. But the storyteller reminds us that she didn't notice the crack in her clay pot of flour, the vessel of nourishment she was carrying home. The storyteller doesn't tell us why she doesn't notice. It doesn't matter. It's just a fact. But the author is saying if you don't notice those facts, the cracks in the system, if you are not mindful, if you're not paying attention to injustice, if you don't live deliberately, that is, radically, instead of merely habitually, you might lose your very means of keeping yourself and your children alive and thriving, not just biologically, but spiritually too. Alive in your heart, alive in your mind, reasoning generously and relinquishing any power you have that tends to keep both you and others in the mud. When you live deliberately, experimentally, you might find strength among others in community, like I did that day at Yale. And I think I grew a bit more human that day. And finally, our mission is also beautifully revealed in the story I told this morning about two fishing families. If you are looking through the lens of categorical diversity, one is a black family, both members are female, different ages. The other is a white family, different ages, both of them are male. And both families are depicted as living in a culture where diversity is not a strength, but a terror, where true hospitality, that is, mutual hospitality, is forbidden, and where the generous heart and reasoning mind are completely unwelcome. "Watch it, boy," says the father to his son. "Look at the water," says the mother to the daughter. And where the privileged family in the story has no intention of relinquishing any aspect of the system that keep both families in the mud of Jim Crow. But the little girl in the story feels for the boy who didn't catch any fish. In other words, she pays attention to her generous heart. She allows herself to reason, therefore, more deeply. Suddenly, she sees a potential friendship that is not wrong just because they are different, or diverse, as we like to say. She knows that she isn't supposed to be talking to that potential friend, but she wants to be hospitable to him, to teach him a trick she knows that fetches fish each and every time. So without any magic, without any supernatural power, she breaks from the pattern that keeps everything and everyone in their place. She teaches the boy a new and helpful way to fish. And at the end of the story, the little white boy relinquishes ever so slightly his position in society, so clearly articulated by his father, by waving back at her and smiling. "That's not much," you say. "That's such a little thing." "So is an atom," I say. "Hard to see even with the best of microscopes. But you know what? We're made of them. We're built of them. And justice, I say, is built on small things too, on the simple mission claimed by ordinary people like us." Ordinary people? Oh, yes. For in the words of Adrienne Rich, yet another radical feminist who, along with Mary Daly, taught me a great deal back in seminary, "We are ordinary people who, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." And I would finally add, reconstitute ourselves. For after all, are we not, each and every one of us, part and parcel of the body of humankind, the world?